But we were able to get Peter Boyle, who is a Green Left journalist and socialist activist and a member of Socialist Alliance, on the show. Welcome, Peter.
Good morning.
Now, Peter, we've got you on the program today to hopefully give us a little bit of an update on what is happening in Rojava. So to start off, can you give us a little bit of an update on what's happening on the ground in Rojava, including the Kurdish city of Kobani?
Yes, it's a very dire situation because since earlier this year, since the beginning of January, there has been basically what appears to be a planned military assault by the current Syrian transitional government led by Ahmed al-Sharaa. And this is basically a government that over the last year has been strongly supported by the Western imperial powers. And it's led by a self-appointed president who was a former commander of al-Qaeda. So this is a government based on very reactionary forces that has been basically rehabilitated politically for the world by the West, because it has now been chosen as its main ally in the region. Now, the story is becoming clearer. On January the 4th, there was a secret meeting between several big powers, including the United States, France, Israel, and this new Syrian regime in Paris. And at this meeting, basically, they seem to have come to an agreement that the big imperialist powers would stop supporting the the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces, which had liberated for some time roughly a third of Syrian territory in the direction of the northeast. At the time, there was an agreement that had been reached earlier the previous year, in March 10th of last year, between the Rojava administration and particularly the SDF, or Syrian Democratic Forces, and the new regime, to try and negotiate a peaceful process to integrate into unified Syria, one in which there would be considerable autonomy for the areas that were part of Rojava. But that agreement was never implemented. It was stalling all along. And therefore, it now becomes clear there's a second track, secret discussion going on with the US and its imperial allies with the new regime. And this came to a head at the beginning of this year. So everything starts to roll very fast from that. First of all, an attack on predominantly Kurdish and Yazidi neighborhoods in Aleppo, which is the second largest city in Syria. This is a part which is overall not in the SDF's control, but they have had autonomous neighborhoods which were armed and were protected by the SDF. So first of all, attacks start against these neighborhoods in Aleppo. And instead of being allowed to defend themselves, which they could have, the United States envoy, Tom Barrack, in the region, who's a very shady character, under the previous Trump administration, actually, he was facing charges of being a so-called agent of foreign influence, because he's been taking money from a lot of the regional powers, from a lot of the Arab states around the country, as part of his business interests. Anyway, this guy, Tom Barrack, intervenes in a discussion and says to the Kurds, remove your armed forces from the neighborhoods in Aleppo. We'll peacefully escort you out, and we will ensure that the neighborhoods will be safe. And nobody really totally believes that, but under huge pressure, the SDF removes its main forces. However, the local self-policing security force decide to stay with their neighborhoods and their people, and they are promptly attacked by the new Syrian regime and by various militias, jihadist militias who are working with them. And there's this horrible rampage through those neighborhoods. People are killed, bodies are desecrated, fleeing residents are separated between men and women. Some of the men and young boys are put in buses and taken away and never to be heard from again. I've spoken to some family members who live in Australia who have lost their family members in this process. The following next few days, the same thing happens to another piece of territory not far away, just slightly north of Aleppo, and that is territory that has been controlled by the SDF, or the Kurds, Kurdish-led forces, since the collapse of the Assad regime. And this was an attempt to make a kind of a bridge between Rojava and these neighborhoods in Aleppo. Same thing basically happens. The United States intervenes, says, no, you've got to withdraw. This will be a protective withdrawal. The SDF, again under pressure, withdraws from these areas. Even before the withdrawal is complete, they are attacked and they lose a lot of people. And basically this has been going on all along, ever since then. They're being forced to withdraw fundamentally because the United States and the European Union have switched sides completely and abandoned the Kurds and the Rojava revolution. This was becoming clear for people who were watching. But then finally, as this process goes on and the Kurds are pushed further and further north, on January 21st, Tom Barrack, who's this U.S. special envoy, puts out a very, very blunt statement on X, where he says, historically, the Kurds were a useful partner in the fight against Islamic State, or ISIS, but now the situation has fundamentally changed. The government is now supporting the al-Shara Syrian transitional government. It's going to be our primary partnership. And the Kurds basically have to surrender their armed forces. Individual members might be accepted into the Syrian armed forces after they have been politically vetted. All control of those areas that were liberated by the Kurds in Rojava have to be handed over. So the U.S. made it very clear, it's abandoned this alliance, which has been going on for some time with the Kurds, with Europe, basically to fight ISIS. So everything has changed now in the last few days. The attack has rolled on, despite officially there being a four-day ceasefire. And Rojava now is reduced to two small areas. One is an area around Kobani, which was the scene of a historic extremely heroic battle between 2014 and 2015, where it was besieged by a series of jihadist militia, including ISIS, and was eventually, after this historic siege, which is being compared to the siege of Stalingrad, after thousands of lives were lost, basically they freed themselves, and that began the turning of the tide against ISIS, and started an offensive, which the Kurds led, which eventually led to the collapse of the so-called ISIS or Islamic Caliphate in 2019. So right now, the Rojava is reduced to an area around Kobani. It's completely surrounded. To its north is Turkey, which has built a fortified fence. It's got its tanks there. They've been cut off from water, electricity, and the internet. They have some intermittent internet connection through Turkish internet services that goes off and on. So they're basically, like 350,000 people are trapped in that area, and they are having to fight for their lives. A bit further to the north is a bigger area around the de facto capital of Rojava, Temeswar, and it is, being being currently, it's there's not active fighting, but there's tension all around the edges, and it's expected that that fighting will break out as soon as in the next couple of days. Essentially, what's happened is the SDF has been forced to retreat to the predominantly Kurdish areas. Now, the SDF was actually not just the Kurds. It was an alliance with various Arab tribes in the area who over the last few years had worked peacefully together with the Kurds in Rojava, trying to implement this, grassroots democracy, which included all the different nationalities and religions. But what it appears is the leadership of many of this Arab sections of the SDF, as soon as it became clear that the Syrian transitional government was on a full military assault and that the U.S. and Europe were going to support them, they began switching sides. So this partly accounts for the speed of the retreat of the SDF. So that's where we are up today. It's down for a fight for survival for Rojava, which it's a very, very sad time, because Rojava was probably, well, the only surviving, I think, revolutionary, truly revolutionary and liberationist impulse from the, what you could broadly call the Arab Spring protests. Mm. And in fact, if you want to think of it, it's actually the only revolutionary liberationist project that we are seeing since the Chavista revolution in Venezuela, way back, at the beginning of this century. It's the only possibly surviving 21st century revolution, and it's now being besieged by an awful alliance of Islamic fundamentalists, almost al-Qaeda type forces, and the imperialist countries.
It's pretty harrowing to see the reports coming out of there, Peter. As someone who's witnessed the whole war on terror that followed the September 11 attacks, can you just comment on the just profound hypocrisy and the profound moral bankruptcy of the US after spending 25 years talking about saving the world from, Islamic extremists and blah, 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 as soon as the geopolitics and the international, imperialists chessboard says it's a good idea, they'll just throw the Kurds under the bus. And all of this rhetoric about defending women and defending civil rights and blah, blah, blah is just shown to be complete mealy-mouthed bullshit.
It is pretty astounding, isn't it? But when you think of it, that all that pretense has been pretty much blown out of the water by the Trump administration, and certainly that in its second round, right? Trump has basically made it very clear he doesn't believe all that shit.
Mm.
It's all about power, and it's about asserting U.S. imperial power. I think the real embarrassment now, if you like, is for the governments of Western Europe and Australia, all these people who are still sticking by as solid military allies of the United States, despite the pretense being totally dropped by Trump. What are they saying, And this is where the silence from our Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, is deafening. They're saying nothing. They're squirming a bit in Western Europe. Macron's making a few statements. German government is terribly silent. I think the British government, Starmer government, is squirming a little bit. Of course, it's all blown out of the water. That old saying, some ancient Tory made, I think in the 18th century or 19th century, about the British imperial power having no friends, only interests. Well, now we know that applies absolutely with today's imperial powers.
And is there a path, a people-powered path, to stop this genocide? Like, we've seen around the world the huge protests in solidarity with Gaza over the last couple of years, and you're old enough to remember, and I'm old enough to remember, when Palestine solidarity protests were more of a, you know, fringe thing from socialists who understood the politics of what was happening there and understood the importance of standing with the people of Palestine. But it snowballed and it took off because people gained an understanding that the people of Palestine were, you know, facing a genocide, facing extermination. Is there potential to build something like that in support of the Kurdish population of Rojava?
There is a potential for something like this to build up international solidarity campaign, because there was a huge campaign that built up between 2014, 2015 around the siege of Kobani. It became, the female Kurdish fighter became almost, you know, the modern symbol of standing up against empire, and people from all around the world flocked there. There were internationalists who went over to fight to help defend Kobani, gave their lives. There was a huge movement of solidarity. Wherever things have roll back in this regard, you know, over the years, because people got complacent. The politics within part of the progressive movement started to go a bit dodgy. One section of the left wanting to defend the Assad dictatorship, another section of the left being throwing its weight behind the so-called Free Syria Army, you know, the remnants of the opposition to Assad during the Syrian civil war, opposition that became increasingly captured by other regional powers like Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and in its political complexion became more conservative and Islamist in its politics. Nevertheless, there was one section of, like, the left progressive movement said, oh, these are the true voices of the Syrian people. So that the left was divided on this politically. I would have to say that in this country, the Socialist Alliance is one of the few countries that has basically kept its support for Rojava right through this process. You know, we've been speaking out, being active in building solidarity. Now, in the region, there is, of course, already a massive movement to defend Rojava. Thousands of people have gathered from Turkey, mostly Kurds, of course, on the border. They are currently fighting with the Turkish army. There's video coming out. There is fighting going on. They want to cross over the border to help defend Kobani. From the further northeast, from Iraq, which is, that part of Iraq is the so-called Kurdistan Regional Government of Iraq. It's an autonomous area, mainly populated by Kurds. From there, again, thousands have come to the border. Now, that border is open because it's controlled by Rojava, and, supplies are coming in. Supplies are coming in. Volunteers are coming in. Some armed forces from the Iraqi Kurdistan have come in, so we're not so much worried about that, because that there's an actual, if you like, a line from the outside world, and international support is coming that way. The biggest challenge is going to be Kobani, because basically, having learned the lesson of what happened in the siege of Kobani, the Turkish state has built this huge wall, a bit like the walls that Israel was built to divide the West Bank, and you know, it's got its armed forces there. But nevertheless, people are messing. Now, this impacts quite, and maybe this might be offer some possibility of pushing back the powerful outside forces, including the imperialist countries and Turkey, from supporting a full-on war of extermination of Rojava. And I say this is because of the potential of things exploding in Turkey. Well, they are now. There's been a so-called, you know, a Kurdish-initiated peace process, but I'd say this is pretty much dead now. And there is a very large section of Turkish population is Kurdish and pro-Kurdish, and they are spoiling for a fight. So if you like, the revolution may explode, the Kurdish-led revolution may now explode in Turkey, and that might make the imperialists feel, oh, you know, perhaps we better broker some sort of settlement here.
Or could it mean that the U.S. will send troops there, maybe even surreptitiously to support the Turkish and the Syrian leaders?
Well, they have troops there already, not a lot, you know, but they have troops in the country, and they have airfields. And, of course, Turkey is NATO ally, and they have huge military bases there. Yes, I mean, the U.S. certainly has the capacity to intervene dramatically to finish off the what's left of Rojava. There's no doubt. We've seen what the U.S. military can still do, you know, as we just saw recently in Venezuela. But it's political in the end, isn't it? You know, this is going to be decided politically rather than purely as to whether they have the military capacity, because we know they have. You know, I mean, the shape. If anybody had any illusions about what the shape of the world is, you know, the preponderance, the domination of the United States, despite its weakening economy, you know, it is still the imperial hegemon. It has the biggest military force of any country in the world. It has the capacity to intervene everywhere. You know, it's got military bases everywhere. And so we know that. That's not the good news, that's the bad news. If anything, you know, what Trump has done is just help the world see things for what they are.
Mm.
But in the end, it is political.
Yeah.
You know, what can they afford to lose?
And if there were mobilizations within the U.S., perhaps as well, I'm sure there are some now, but and I wonder how ordinary soldiers in the U.S. military must be feeling at the moment about all of the things that they're being asked to do when they're seeing their own country, as in Minnesota, being almost like a civil war in Minnesota. I just wonder if, and I don't know if you can answer this, Peter, but if there would be any kind of unrest within the U.S. Army amongst ordinary soldiers.
I think it's possible. There is a video clip that's going viral right now of a U.S. A female U.S. soldier stationed in Syria, and she's making this. She's speaking to camera in tears, you know, about what she sees as a betrayal. Now, you know, we've got to check all these things, and there's so much video going around which might or might not be true, but it's definitely gone viral. It's gone viral together with another video which is absolutely horrible, and it's one of the Syrian militia groups holding up the braid of hair from a woman, Kurdish fighter, who allegedly he has raped and killed, and he's sort of waving it as a trophy, and that's gone absolutely viral. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of stuff going around like that. I mean, you have to imagine that some members of the in the U.S. armed forces are feeling really bad not just about what's happening overseas, in Syria and the threats to Greenland, but also at home, as you said in Minnesota, you have to think that there are people thinking, I don't know what stage this is at. You know, are people just feeling doing, or is there, the beginnings of a rumbling a resistance within the armed forces, like we saw during the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
It was powerful. It was very powerful. Soldiers didn't want to fight. Some soldiers even turned their weapons against their officers at one point. It was a huge movement. It was a huge movement that was part of the anti-Vietnam War movement.
Well, Peter, this has been a really great interview, but we are coming to the end. And I just wanted to... Well, we want to keep showing our solidarity, particularly with the Kurds who are mobilizing against the impending genocide, including the Kurdish Women's Protection Unit fighters in northern East Syria, resisting the Turkish-backed Syrian government forces.
There are protests happening, literally every few days now in all the major cities in Australia, in Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, Perth, and we had one in Canberra a couple of days ago. And so there's an opportunity for people to come and support them. You know, the numbers of non-Kurdish people at this protest, they're too few. The word needs to get out. People need to show solidarity. They need to declare declare their humanity, because that's really what's at stake here. You know, they need to come and put their bodies there and stand side by side with these Kurdish communities who feel completely abandoned at this moment, completely abandoned.
Yeah, absolutely. And, just lastly, the Rojava revolution, it does represent a threat to Western imperialism and all the reactionary regimes in the region. I was reading a quote from journalist Behrouz Bichani, who once said he once called Rojava the most progressive and democratic system in the history of the Middle East. So you did mention the rallies across the country, Peter, but I guess just to wrap up the interview, why is it important that all socialists actively support Rojava in its hour of existential need?
Yeah, because Rojava does stand more for something more than just a territory. It stands for a different vision of how society can be run. It's fundamentally based on a very powerful thing. We've never seen a revolution so much based on the empowerment and the liberation of women. And that's been iconic for this revolution. And it's, doubly iconic, because it's taking place in a region where, if anything, the trend has been the opposite direction. Women have been forced to wear the veil, been turned back to hide in their homes, to be sold as chattel. And this is a revolution that puts that up front. Every single position has to be led by, shared with a co-chair, with a woman, et cetera. So there's been this huge empowerment of women. Secondly, it is based on a cooperative system. It's, an indigenous cooperative system, but there's a whole series of cooperatives that actually run large sections of the economy in Rojava. And finally, it's not been easy for them to implement this. They have at least a formal political commitment and constitutional commitment to respect for the environment. So you got these three elements together with a vision of grassroots democracy that is, they call it confederalism. It organizes right from the lowest layer, and it is inclusive of all different communities, despite whatever their religions, ethnicity, etc. So this was an experiment that has been going on there. We need to defend it, because in the end, it's not just Syria. It's every country in the region has this challenge, has a challenge of empowerment of women. It's a challenge to even achieve the most basic elements of gender equality, but also has societies which are multi-ethnic and multi-religious in character. And the imperialists have been exploiting this by turning one community against the other, and that's how they've maintained their rule from way back in the times when the British and the French carved up the area before the US came along. That's the game they were playing, pitting one section of society against another. So in that sense, it's profoundly subversive of the main form of imperial power maintaining itself. You know, this confederalism, this attempt to unify all these groups, you know, and to empower women, this makes this project one very subversive of imperial power.
Yeah, thank you for joining us on the program, Peter, and for all your work in the Kurdish Solidarity Campaign. And
yeah, cheers, Peter.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Bye, Peter.
See ya.
And we encourage everyone to stand with the Kurdish people right now and demand that to stop the war against the Kurds and stand for peace, justice and freedom. Stay with us. We're going to just go to a short break.
The revolution in Rojava is a beacon of hope for the world, putting direct democracy and feminism into practice on a broad scale. This radical attempt at social transformation now faces huge challenges, including daily attacks by the Turkish military with little outside recognition or aid. Show your support for Rojava by joining Northeast Syria Solidarity, or NESS, and help ensure the survival of this inspiring experiment in social change. NESS sends aid, raises awareness, and builds solidarity. Get involved at www.nesssolidarity.org.au. NESS is a 3CR supporter.